Jane Smiley has a new book out. It's Some Luck. It's actually part one of a trilogy, which is three books if you didn't go to grad school. Some Luck, it's called, or Some Luck, or Some Luck. There's various ways of looking at it. We'll find out which she does right now. She's on the line with us from California, and I'm pressing the button, and nothing is happening on this phone here. So can you put Jane Smiley on, do you think, for me?
Hello.
Hi, Jane. I'm sorry. My button wasn't working. Not the first time.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm here.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Are you on a big book tour now for this thing already, or are you not?
I am on a big book tour. I'm home temporarily, but I'm leaving very soon to continue the big book tour.
Big book tour. We're talking many cities. Different continents involved?
Yes. Well, if you call the UK a continent, they call it a continent. But.
That's continental. I guess it's slightly different. So this is great. This is a trilogy now. This is quite an undertaking. Are they all written?
It's all written, except for the last little bits, which take place 2016, 17, 18, and 19.
Oh, yeah. Are you going to wait for those to happen before you can finish
it? No, absolutely not. I'm going to look in my crystal ball.
Yeah. So first we had a 1,000 acres. Now we have 1,000 pages, basically.
Well, no, I'm sorry, but I couldn't hold it down like that. So it has to be more like 1,300.
This is about the same length as Clarissa, isn't it? I was looking up.
Yes, but it's about more than one seduction.
More than one seduction. There are multiple seductions and all kinds of things. And it's about a farm family in Denby, Iowa, the Langdons, Rosanna and Walter, and their five children and everything that flows from that. And usually you have one protagonist, but we have multiple protagonists in this case.
Well, aren't there multiple protagonists in every family? Wouldn't every family disagree about who's the actual protagonist?
Yeah. Is that a negative protagonist? I thought it was someone that just sort of the action goes through them and then they're the focus. It's not negative necessarily, is it, to say a protagonist?
No. I see the firstborn, his name is Frank, as more like the tree trunk, and then the other limbs go their own ways, as it were.
Yeah. And so you're going, what, 30 years at a time? It's 100 years, right, the whole trilogy?
Yes, 100 years. The original trilogy title is The Last 100 Years. And the first volume is about 33 years, the second volume is about 34, and the third volume is about 33.
Yeah. And it's remarkably complete look at what their lives were like year by year, starting in what, 1921?
1920. Early 1920. Yeah. Yes, it goes year by year. The years are just about equal. Not exactly. I wish I could have done that, but I didn't.
Yeah, because it doesn't come out equal.
So the whole trilogy moves forward year by year from 1920 to 2019.
Yeah. And was this extrapolated from somebody's Bible that had all these dates written on it?
No, it wasn't. It just came to me as the title. And then the title sort of dictated the form to me. And I knew that Walter and Rosanna, those are the parents, they were born in 1895 and 1900. And I knew that Frank was born in 1920, and then it was like having children. I just gave the children their characteristics that they were born with, like certain modes of attention or certain ways of being, and then I set them going in this world.
Yeah, that's the way to do it, actually, instead of actually having them, and it's happenstance.
Yeah.
You can actually create characters and create children for yourself.
I was quite interested in writing about babies and children because in my experience as a mom, the babies are quite distinct practically from day one, and so that's always fascinated me as a just as a human characteristic. I mean, even colts and fillies are distinct, even puppies are distinct. So
true.
So I wanted to get into that in this book and let them be born and grow up and find their own you know, lovers and marital partners and
no.
have their own children and, you know, scratch their heads
and
forever.
It's so steeped in farm life. You had a farm for a brief time, I guess, but you're from Los Angeles, but you live in Iowa.
Well, I was born in Los Angeles. Yeah. I was born in Los Angeles. I grew up in St. Louis.
Right.
In the suburbs, and I lived in Iowa for 24 years. I lived on a farm, but I didn't ever own a farm. I lived in a farmhouse, and the land had been taken over by the neighbor farmers and was farmed by those people, but we lived in the farmhouse.
Yeah. Maybe Joe was doing those fields as well, right? He was farming like three or four different fields.
I think so. The neighbor was a very nice guy, and so it might have been Joe.
Yeah. There's two among the family, the two brothers, Frank and Joe, and they're kind of, there's a little bit of Cain and Abel going on there.
Well, Frank is one of those tough guy older brothers.
Yeah.
Now, Walter, the father, at one point says he doesn't think he's giving the right one the beatings because Frank's getting the beatings and they aren't helping any to tame him, and Joe isn't getting any beatings and maybe he needs a little toughening up. So it's a parental dilemma.
Yeah, and Joe is like, but he's like, which one? Cain, Rose? It's like Abel. He's more like Abel. He's like,
yeah.
He's the farmer, and he names his animals. I mean, which isn't that prohibited on a farm? I thought that you weren't allowed to do that if you're a farm
kid.
You're
never supposed to do that, no.
Yeah, but he names them all.
You're not supposed to name the animals.
And he names them all in pairs for some reason.
Well, what he really wants when he's a little boy is a puppy, but no, there's no way they're going to ever let him have a puppy.
No. And so Frank then is quite the opposite of that. And but he ends up going in the army and being involved in like every major war or every major battle in World War II.
Well, no, he's not. He goes to the North African campaign and then the Italian campaign.
Yeah.
And then Then they send him to Nice.
Oh, then they send him to Nice.
To the south of France.
Yeah.
I that was quite interesting doing my research about the Second World War, about the soldiers who went through the south of France. They had a lovely time. It wasn't quite nearly like Normandy. They had a much better time. So that was their reward for putting up with all the horrors in Italy.
Yeah. But he was a sniper?
Yes, he was a sniper. There were a few of those. They weren't as common in Europe as they were in the Pacific campaign, and they weren't as common in the Army as they were in the Marines. But he's the type of guy who's always looking into the distance and seeing things. Mm-hmm. And so I decided he needed to be a sniper.
Sniper. But his dad, in the start of the book, it was back from France. He'd been in France, right?
Yes, he'd been in France for a short time.
Yeah.
He'd gone into the army, and then he had been in France for long enough, but he hadn't really been in the war. It was like a lot of Americans in the First World War. The war ended before they really had to do as much as the French and the English had to do.
Yeah. When the son comes back from World War II, though, it's somewhat different because he's actually a changed man from his experience.
Well, is he? I'm not sure he is. You know, he's developed.
Yeah.
He's now a man, as it were. But I don't know that he's that different from who he was before. I think maybe the war reconfirmed his sense of the world and his sense of himself.
Oh, well, of course, I can't see beyond 1952.
No, you can't. It's unfortunate for those who have only read Volume 1.
Yeah, okay, so I don't really know what happens. But I thought he came back, you know, a little bit with what they treat now in guys coming back from Iraq and so forth, they have these experiences that they no longer can relate to civilian life. And I got a little bit of that from him, that he's walking around, he's living his life, and he's married now, and he has kids all of a sudden, but he's not really living in that life.
Maybe that's true. I'm not sure that's owing to the war, though.
Well,
I'm not sure he was just ever quite suited for domestic life.
Yeah.
He was a wild kid, you know?
Yeah. And the whole farming thing, how did you, it's amazing because you're in all the crops and the crop failures and what's being planted and how many bushels and all this stuff. How did you research all that or get that sort of lifestyle, a farm lifestyle?
Well, there was plenty of information. I mean, my three favorite websites were a Nebraska website for a model farm, an Iowa website for a model farm, and a Iowa State University website for weather. So the two model farm websites had interviews with lots of farmers about what farming had been like during various decades. And they also had wonderful photographs of farms and implements and techniques and ways to do stuff. And then the Iowa State website, which I use for weather, basically tells you what the weather was like every day of the year since, I don't know, 1900 or something. Mm-hmm. And that's really fascinating because farmers and people living in the country in general pay a lot of attention to the weather, and the weather really affects what they're doing day by day and what will happen to their crops and what will happen to their income. And so maybe because I lived in Iowa, but also because I lived in Missouri and a tornado went by right down the street when I was 6 years old, 7 years old, the weather is really interesting to me. So there's a great deal of weather in this book.
Yeah, and farmers have to be interested in the weather because
yeah.
There's no getting around it. And I guess I read somewhere you said driving through the Amish country so often you sort of osmoted, some of that osmoted in your thinking about the countryside and about farming.
Yes, that's when I lived in the abandoned farmhouse. Mm-hmm. I lived about 30 miles southwest of Iowa City, and so we drove through Amish country to get to the town that we lived in. And I always had my head hanging out the window looking at what was going on. And that was also a time when I lived there when a book came out called The Closing Circle about environmentalism and the ecosystem. And I remember looking at the water supply coming out of our tap and saying, I wonder what's in there. So I got interested. As soon as I moved to Iowa, I got interested in the ecology of farming and the farming way of life, just in that whole world.
Yeah. And then we get into besides the farming and all that, so also get into sort of to other things that are occurring at the time or issues or human feelings, including like Rosanna, for example, is sort of the spiritualist or the religious seeker.
Well, you know who's buried south of Ames, Iowa, on a hillside south of Ames, Iowa, is Billy Sunday.
Right, right.
And I didn't know too much about Billy Sunday until I went to the Baseball Hall of Fame and discovered that Billy Sunday started out as a phenomenal. He was from Story County, Iowa, and he started out as a phenomenal but very odd baseball player in Chicago.
Was he a pitcher?
No, he was a base stealer.
A base stealer.
And he also had a very difficult time playing in shoes because he had grown up playing barefoot. But he was quite famous in his day, which was, I can't even remember when it was now, like the late 19th century, for being a great base stealer. He worked for Cap Anson, who I think, for the Cubs. And... Oh. So that was fascinating to me that he'd gone, and when he became an evangelist, his signal move was to run on stage as if he were stealing the base, slide into home. And so I just had to, since he was a local Iowa boy, I just had to get Billy Sunday in there.
Got him in there. And she was enamored of him or at least attracted to, well, she was attracted to various religious things, but he was
one
of them.
Yeah, she has a crisis, an emotional crisis, and she needs some solace, and Billy Sunday is giving a revival, and they go to the revival. So that happens in 1925 or 6. So that was interesting to put that in. But, you know, the characters you know, they aren't isolated. They live on the farm, but they aren't isolated from the world they live in. They must react to the things that happen, and lots of things happen, you know, not only the war, but, you know, and the depression, but things after the war and all through the 20s. So they live in the world like we do, and they have to react to it.
And the kids all end up on either coast, and one in Washington, D.C., and involved in even the Red Scare, or whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
The J. Edgar
Well,
Hoover.
one of my favorite characters. I do say that I'm fond of my characters, but they feel like family. You know, you have complaints about them, but the people that they marry. I love them as if I had these romantic attachments to them. One, Andy is the one that Frank married. She's from Decorah, Iowa.
Yeah.
And in her family, they speak Norwegian in the house. And Arthur is the mysterious one that Lillian marries, who comes into her soda fountain one day and then spirits her away a few days later. And Arthur is a mystery man.
Yeah. He's like the FBI or CIA or something.
Well, you decide. You'll find out in volume 2.
Oh, God. It's a scam, isn't it? We got to buy all 3 to know what's going on here.
Well, my favorite compliment, which I've been getting, it's amazing to me that on, you know, 3 or 4 days after publication, people come up to me in bookstores and say, I've finished it. I can't wait for volume 2. I want to know what happens. So that's my favorite compliment.
This is like Dickens, right? It's a serial. You got to.
That's exactly right.
Get each copy. Is there something Dickensian about this, and all the characters and so forth?
I know he's a favorite. I don't think so, because I don't feel that I'm of a Dickensian turn of mind, though I love Dickens. I feel that I'm more of a Trollopian turn of mind.
Yeah.
But he too, you know, wrote many volumes, and you wanted to find out what was going to happen next. And so maybe I'm of a 19th century turn of mind.
Could be. I mean, I've read all, you know, not all the books, but most of them. You're of a lot of turns of mind.
Well, I like different forms.
Yeah.
And I always have, and I've always wanted to write in all different types of forms just to try them out. But, you know, you're writing a tragedy and you think, boy, there's nothing funny in here. And then you're writing, you know, a comedy and you're thinking, this seems a little shallow. And then you're thinking, well, but there's no magical characters in here. So you have to write a book set at the racetrack where there's some magical characters.
Yeah.
So if you really, or if, in my case, if I really love reading all kinds of books, that makes me want to write all kinds of books, too.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting about this is usually you read a novel or whatever you're reading and expect some major events and, you know, a turn of events and followed by a denouement, I think that's what. But, you know, and it's not exactly what happens here. It's more or less tracking this family. And there's events that happens, big and small, along the way, but it's very lifelike, really.
Well, yes, I mean, that's what happens. And I don't think I could have written this book when I was young, because I didn't realize that then, that climaxes come and go of all kinds, you know, and that you and that when something really bad happens, well, yes, you're going to get through that, and it's going to become smaller as you look back on it. And something really good happens, and you're going to get through that too.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things that, you know, I came up with this book when I was, what was it, I was 60. Hmm. And that was when I first came up with the idea. And I think the fact that I had gone through lots of events in my life said to me, you know, well, there needs to be a trilogy like that, or, you know, some books like that too, where the characters just go through them. They live through them, and then they reflect upon them and look back upon them and learn from them.
Yeah. In a sense, though, sir, it defies expectations or convention, really, of the novel form, doesn't it?
So far.
Yeah. So far is that... Oh, okay. So we got to see 2 and 3. Okay.
Maybe that's the answer to, maybe that's the title of volume two, yeah. So Far.
Yeah, Some Luck and then So Far. And then how about that is volume three?
Yeah, how about that? Oh, that's boy. A good answer. That's a good title for volume three. How yes. about that? I'll suggest that to them.
Okay. And Some Luck is obviously could go either way, too. That's what I like about that.
Mm-hmm.
As in good or bad.
But I heard you wondering about the pronunciation of Some Luck, and I have to say I pronounce it Some Luck.
That's pretty even.
I want to get that ambiguity in there, you know.
Some Luck is probably the most common way I would think of doing it. Some Luck. Or some. I could use Some Luck, you know, but then you have to say.
We all could use Some Luck.
Yeah. Well, it's an amazing effort.
Thank you.
The Langdons, and it's really quite amazing. Who does trilogies anymore? Are there trilogies going on? I suppose in fantasy.
You didn't read the Twilight series?
No.
You didn't read Harry.
Oh, right, that's right. Those are, yeah, but that's like in the fantasy world, right?
Yeah. But, you know, trilogies aren't so common. But, you know, John Updike did a trilogy, the Rabbit trilogy.
Oh, that's true.
And they're interesting to do because they require a lot of pruning, a lot of shaping. So from a craft point of view, they're an interesting challenge.
Yeah. But, you know, the cliff notes for it will be the size of a regular book.
I hope so.
Jane, I want to thank you for taking the time. I know you got lots of things to do. The book is called Some Luck. Jane
well,
Smiley.
Michael, thank you for having me. It was really fun.
Nice talking to you again. Jane Smiley, yes. Ladies and gentlemen, from Panel Valley, California. Some Luck. Volume 1.